Greetings from England. I'm in Reading, in the south of the country, not far from Oxford. Today, I'd like to introduce you to the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. In the original Hebrew Bible, it seems Ezra and Nehemiah were one book. They were written on one scroll. Although, I will follow the convention of two separate books as I present the next four iFaith messages. Number 109 today is called Trek, and number 110, which will be the next, is called Torah. This is the Persian period. The temple has fallen, Israel has fallen, and Ezra and Nehemiah are returning from the heart of power in the Persian Empire to the Holy Land, thanks to Cyrus and a decree that this Persian emperor made. And I'll read that in a moment. In these books, there's a triple focus, if you will. There's a focus on the temple. The foundations are laid soon, but it takes quite a while before everything's completed. Then there's the wall, the city wall, which is completed under Nehemiah. Oh, and also the law, because, all right, they've got this barrier, and they're separate from the world, they've got a wall, but what really should separate God's people from the world is not something physical, but something that's in the heart. So there's that triple focus, the temple. Israel was called not just to have priests, but to be a priestly community. And the priest had failed to teach the law. Maybe it was as messy as Malachi describes later in the book of Malachi. As far as the law, God's people are to be the people of the book and are supposed to actually meditate on the word daily. As far as the wall, it's not just a physical separation, but in Nehemiah, the wall is what keeps merchants out so that the Sabbath can be honored and all this buying and selling, all the commerce can end at least one day a week. In these ways, being a priestly community, all the Jews, the law, the holy book, and the wall, separation, physical and spiritual, God's people were different to other nations. They were truly unique. Now, I mentioned Cyrus, the Persian emperor, the one who took Babylon, bringing in to the Babylonian Empire. Cyrus said, and these words are found in the Silas cylinder. It's a cylinder seal. It's rolled out onto a flat, wet clay, and the letters in the seal will come up, of course, the mirror image, and then that clay will harden, and that way multiple copies of a decree can be put everywhere in the empire. Anyway, if you want to see the Cyrus cylinder, go to the British Museum. But you can see the gist of it in the beginning of Ezra 1, or in the very end of 2 Chronicles, which comes right before Ezra. Let me give you the gist of what Cyrus says. I returned to these sacred cities. Now, he's not talking about Jerusalem only. He's talking about all the important cities in the Persian Empire because he wants to make a good impression. He says, the sanctuaries of which have been in ruins for a long time because the Babylonians, like the Assyrians, they just destroyed everything, scorched earth. But the Persians had a different philosophy of leadership. They said, let's work through the infrastructure that's already there. Let's not reinvent the wheel. In fact, we think the people will be easier to govern if they're feeling better spiritually. So he says, I return to the sacred cities, the sanctuaries, and the images that used to live in them. Of course, with Israel, there's no image. There's no image of God. But for most of the empire, all the empire, there's an image, except for the Jews. And establish their sanctuaries. That means that the Persian government is paying for this. Wow. And he gathered all the former inhabitants and returned them to their habitations. That is, he made it possible for God's people to return to Israel. So that's Cyrus, and he's viewed as a very special person. In Isaiah, in fact, he's called the Anointed One, the Messiah. Not that he's in a right relationship with God, but in Isaiah 44 and 45, Cyrus, the Persian emperor, is the special instrument of God. Now, there's a lot of opposition. We don't meet Ezra until we get to chapter 7, but in the first six chapters, there's a lot of opposition. People are trying to rebuild the temple, but there's resistance from the people who, meanwhile, have taken up residence in the land of Israel, particularly the Samaritans. And the Samaritans said, we worship God like you, but they were too open. They worship other things too. There's a fruitful example. In Egypt, probably around the same time as the Samaritans were getting organized, or maybe just slightly after, there are many Jews who lived in a place called Elephantine, like the word elephant. It's an island in the Nile, a military outpost. But in Elephantine, they built their own temple. They worshiped Yahweh and other gods, like Canaanite gods. And the Samaritans would have said, we're on the same page. We both believe in Yahweh. But Ezra, like Nehemiah, Ezra 4:3, Nehemiah 2, said, no, you're not on the same page. And we'll lose our distinctiveness as God's people if we just become worldly like you. There's that danger of assimilation. So keep that in mind. There's a lot of opposition to the plan to lay the foundation for the temple. And even though the people are returning in 538, the temple's not done until like 516, 515 BC, more than 20 years later. And the enemies of the God's people, like Sanballat and Tobiah, Tobiah the Ammonite, Sanballat, and Geshem the Arab, they wrote letters, official letters, which are in Aramaic. See, Ezra, like Daniel, is in two languages, Hebrew and Aramaic. But they wrote these official letters to authorities to try to stop the Jews from rebuilding the temple or building the walls and so forth. And the fact is, at first it worked, because the Persians were quite sensitive to the possibility of rebellion. Example, Darius, one of the Persian kings, once crucified 3,000 leading Babylonian citizens for possibly being part of a rebellion. Wow, okay. So for decades, that strategy works of intimidation and reporting God's people to the authorities, but eventually it won't work. So we're going to pick up the narrative in chapter 7, and all we'll be reading is, well, Ezra coming to Jerusalem from Babylon. After these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, now listen, Ezra, son of Sariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalom, son of Zadok, and I even left out one, son of Ahitub, Amariah, Azariah, Mariot, Zariah, Uzi, Buzi, Buki, Abishua, Phinehas, Eleazar, Aaron. 17 generations, I count. Woo, he's got a pedigree. He can prove he's descended from Aaron. Great pedigree. Then this Ezra came up from Babylon. Babylon, the place of exile, of captivity. He was a teacher, well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. Now, Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. He had begun his journey from Babylon on the first day of the first month, and he arrived in Jerusalem in the first day of the fifth month, for the gracious hand of his God was on him. We're going to look at one more verse in this chapter, but let me just point out a couple things. Ezra is a priest. In the Old Testament, priests not only presented sacrifices, but they were supposed to teach. They're supposed to preserve knowledge to make sure God's people were on track. He had made a long journey. Now, when you go from Ezra 6 to Ezra 7, Ezra 7 simply says, after these things, during the reign of a certain Persian king. After these things, well, Ezra 6 is 60 years earlier. This is common in the Bible. You get huge jumps. So 60 years later, and which has not been a great time for Israel. But now Ezra comes. Now he comes. And he's made a trek. A trek is not just a walk in the park or walking to the corner grocer. A trek is something that is complicated. So let me talk about the trek. Let me also talk about his pedigree. He was a priest. He had a pedigree. He knew what he was talking about in a time when many priests were worldly. Sometimes we're tempted to look up our ancestors. And these days with DNA and also with various websites, you can find out who you're related to or what kind of blood you have. My brother really enjoys doing this kind of work, genealogical work. I knew before that my ancestors come from the British Isles. That is from Ireland, England, Scotland, Germany, also Finland, Sweden. But he found out a lot of things. Like, we are related to some minor nobility in Scotland. I don't know what I get. I don't know if I get a title. I don't think so, but one of our ancestors, going back not that many generations, was governor of California. Interesting. I also found out through his study that we had relatives in the U.S. state of Georgia who moved to Texas with their slaves. And that did not make me feel very good. And when you go into the past, you'll find out all kinds of stuff. With Ezra, digging back into his past, it's just a pure line all the way to Aaron, I mean, to the first high priest. So that's a good thing. What about this trek? The years, you may have missed that. the fifth month, the seventh year. He started on the first day of the first month. You know, we got, okay, he's losing me there. All right, let me simplify it. He leaves on April the 8th. He arrives on the 4th of August. So he leaves on the 8th of the 4th, arrives on the 4th of the 8th. It's the hottest time of the year. The route avoided the desert, but that doesn't mean there wasn't a danger of bandits. We see that also in Nehemiah. He's left quite a comfortable life. And that journey he has taken is something like 4 months. This is on foot. 4 months. Like Abraham, as Abraham left Ur and his comfortable life there, Ezra has left Babylon. And he was probably a person of respect and some prestige. And he's come all this way. Wow. Why would he come all that way? Because he knew what Israel needed. Now we come to verse 10, probably the best known verse in all of Ezra. For Ezra had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord and to teaching its decrees and laws in Israel. So there are three things here. There's study, observance, and teaching. We're going to talk more about the law and the impact he had next time in the talk called Torah. And Torah is considered to be wisdom. Actually, in Ezra 7:25, Torah is wisdom. If you have Torah, you're wise. But don't think that he's just a well-educated priest, an egghead. He's got guts. And as we'll see also as we continue our study, he challenges Israel. He challenges even the leaders. He has the strength of conviction. He is, in fact, a priest. He's a wise man. He's a prophet and a lawgiver. Very similar to Moses, or in some ways, even to Jesus. So these are the three points for me. Study of the word. I don't care how long you've been a Christian. You need to keep learning God's word or relearning it. I consider that to be extremely important for me. You don't get to a point where I know the Bible well enough. That's just a point of self-deception if you've arrived there. I hope that's not your case. Then secondly, observance of the law. It's not just knowing about it, but it's doing it. It's that thrill, that discovery, that willingness to put it into practice and then to teach. See, if you skip the middle step, oh yes, I've learned all these things and I'm going to teach everybody, you're messed up. You need to actually apply it because that's where your conviction comes from. And it's also where your credibility comes from. When someone's not practicing what he or she preaches, then not good. So we have three things: study, observance, and teaching. I like the way one theologian put it. With study, conduct, and teaching put deliberately in this order, this right order, each of these was able to function properly and at its best. Study saved from unreality, conduct from uncertainty, teaching from insincerity and shallowness. Because when you teach, you have to think things through. And it's very hard to teach something you don't believe in. Conduct saves from uncertainty. Because you have to test it. You need to know for yourself. Otherwise, you don't have that direct knowledge. And study saves from unreality. You know, biblically, we're not retreating into the Bible from the world. When we get into God's word, then we're able to approach the world as it really is. So are you willing to make a trek? Maybe it means traveling a long way to a good church. I don't know. Maybe it means attending conferences. I've always been big on conferences. I mean, my first summer as a Christian, I attended 4, maybe 5. Went to an evangelism seminar in Virginia, one in North Carolina, one in Florida. I went to a retreat in North Carolina. There was something else. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. Maybe you've traveled to Israel, or you're willing to go to the biblical world. It's great. It's a great faith builder. Whatever we do, we need to prioritize the Lord and his word. Make time for it. Budget for it if you need to spend money. And God will smile on you. His light will shine on you like the light coming in my hotel window here that I'm struggling with, as you can see. But we can be like Ezra. You can't manufacture your own genealogy. You can't pretend to be something you're not. But in the three points that made him especially strong, we can follow. We can study. We can practice. And then we can teach. Let's do all three. Next, we're going to learn more about what made Ezra such a powerful figure spiritually. And of course, that's the Torah itself. It's God's word. But that's for iFaith number 110. Thanks for listening.